The second meeting of the Capital Investment Committee will come to order. Will the clerk please note the roll? And it looks to me like there's a quorum here, so we can go forth. Minutes of the first meeting are in your packets. Is there a motion? Representative Juergens moves that the minutes be approved as written. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Good. No corrections either.
Perfect.
Good motion. last week we started the very foundation of setting the things that are important about state investments, state grants, state loans, state matches to communities or projects in the state. That brings us into One Minnesota. And I asked us to each person to begin to think about a project in their district or region that has brought inspiration, that were a project that was built with some portion of state monies for the region or the city or the district that the members represent, that led people to be inspired and move forward. And we had a very good brief and summary of what's happened in the 21st century, but our memories were a little vague and we had to dig a little bit for some of the projects in the 20th century that we're going to talk about. And then I opened it up so that the people that are the followers, the lobbyists and the regular followers and the groupies of the Capital Investment Committee, I offered them the opportunity to present something to this committee that helps us lay the foundation to where we're going in the future, next week and the week after and into May, and then into next year, which is our at the end of our term after the 2020. So we're going forth with that, and we started with former Commissioner Straczynski, who had been Commissioner of Administration in the 70s, and today we have a person on the net, Lisa Frenette from the Red River area, and that's going to tell us about something that inspired her and the people of the area that she represents or comes from. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Frenette, and thank you for being brave and bold to say you'll be the first one today.
Hi, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, members of the committee. I'm not sure that I said I'd be first one of the day today, but here I am, and so I'm happy to kick it off. Good thing I had a cup of coffee early. Good morning. Again, my name is Lisa Frenette, and I represent the Red River Watershed Management Board. The Red River Watershed Management Board is made up of seven different watershed districts whose area encompasses the whole Red River Basin and its tributaries. Red River Basin flows north from about the Wheaton area of Minnesota, to give you some perspective, all the way north into Ottawa and in Winnipeg. The Red River Watershed Management Board was created in 1976 by an act of the Minnesota Legislature to provide an organization with basin-wide perspective to address the flooding issues that they have up in the area. The activities of the Red River Watershed Management Board center on flood control and general water management. Over 40 flood control projects have been constructed in the Minnesota portion of the Red River Basin since the 1970s. These projects provide critical protection for both urban centers and rural areas and reduce the risk of damage to public and private infrastructure that has been constructed or improved in these areas. In addition to providing the important infrastructure protection, these projects enhance water quality and provide resources for wildlife enhancement. An example of an infrastructure project is an impoundment to retain water. When flooding occurs in the Red River Valley, water can be diverted into these impoundments and thereby preventing property damage, reducing erosion, controlling sediment loss, and creating better water quality, and again creating a better wildlife habitat. An example of the longest serving project, and I'm going to have to read off this because it's pretty interesting. The longest serving project that the Red River Watershed Management Board collaborated with the Bois de Sioux Watershed District has benefited from state funding is the North Ottawa Project in Wheaton, Minnesota. The impoundment controls 75 square miles of the 320 square mile Rabbit River watershed in Grant and Otter Tail counties by storing the excess runoff in 1,920 acres of land. The project involves constructing dikes around the perimeter of the impoundment area, building a collection system to bring water to the impoundment, and partitioning the interior to provide a complex of sub-impoundments, thereby bringing the water together, keeping it on the land when there's flooding, and reducing the sediment loss and enhancing the wildlife habitat. Waters carried by the existing drainage ditches are intercepted by diversion channels and brought into the impoundment through the diked inlet channel. It sounds complicated. It's really interesting, and it is probably one of the most beautiful things you'll see in the springtime when the flooding starts to occur or there's an excess water and the wildlife comes in and it stays all summer long. One of the interesting things that we have been able to do in creating these impoundments is for every wetland we take out, we create more wetlands and better quality for the wildlife. So the primary objective is to provide flood damage reduction to 16,000 acre feet of gate controlled storage, which is equivalent to 75% of the estimated 100-year spring runoff. As everyone knows, we have more than 100-year spring runoff in the Red River these days. It assists in reducing peak flows of the Bois de Sioux River at Wahpeton and Breckridge by about 5%, which is huge after that 1997 flood that we had. We needed to figure out how to make sure that those cities were safe, and it enhanced the public infrastructure. The Red River Watershed Management Board and its member watershed districts continue to improve the lives of its constituents by constantly looking for better ways to keep water on the land, which leads to improved water quality while promoting wildlife resources. I have to apologize. As an older woman, I had to get braces the other day for my mouth, and I'm having a tough time talking, everyone. I'm sorry. Thank you. So, and we match our money. The Red River Watershed Management Board matches money with local watershed districts along with state bonding money, federal money, and then we look for other things like through the outdoor, the Lizard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, Lizard Sam's, anything that we can look to help improve the lives and everything up in the Red River. Thank you.
It's a fantastic description of what happened. And I really appreciate it because it's just a blend of many governments working together. But the people are all working together, too, and receiving benefits from it. And the area makes or what you said about the area makes us want to go maybe not so much in the spring, but maybe June,
July, August, September.
Yeah.
It's beautiful up there. We also believe that, real quickly I want to add before I step away, is that the Legislative Water Commission has a priority of keeping the water on the land, and we believe we're in a unique position to help people understand how this can be done. So we're happy as the Red River Watershed Management Board and its member watershed districts to offer and show people what we have done to keep the water on the land up there so we can continue to enhance wildlife and reduce erosion and sediment.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Representative Lilly, you were so disappointed that you didn't get a chance to show us your picture on Tuesday, and I see that you have it with you again today, and we wouldn't want any harm to come to that beautiful picture. So would you please volunteer to give your little project, not little, but your project report to this committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It did almost break last week. That was what the loud bang was, and it does have glass on it. I almost did fail my homework assignment, but luckily I stopped in your office on the way out because I had it all set what I was going to say, but it was not meeting the academic standards that you had put forth, but because it was in the 20th century or not prior to or whatever, so the 21st century. Sorry, thank you. So I did meet the goal. I talked to my senator, and he mentioned a project that that you're aware of. Prior to me, there was a House member named Betty McCollum, and now she went on to other things. The funny part of that, her story is she was actually on the North St. Paul City Council, and then I followed her on that seat, and then I've followed her into the House seat that she had. I do not have any plans to go to Washington ever, other than as a tourist, but I understand that the Smithsonian's closed, and that's one of the places I'd like to really get to, or many other museums, but Representative Hansen's been there and told me great things about them. But so one of the projects that she did with the local people was there was an old Ramsey County, part of my district is Ramsey County, and there aren't many farms left. And so what they did is they moved a farm by Maplewood Mall, and they moved it a little bit, which did kind of wreck it a little bit as far as a historical site, but it did preserve the farm set. And the legislature, and I'm not sure if it was through bonding, because it was interesting to hear about how that all worked through Appropriations Committee also. But so there's a barn that was moved in my district, which may not sound like a big deal to some of you that have thousands and thousands of barns or grew up on a barn. But a barn in the metro is a neat thing, and it's very well used. Maybe you can show it. So here it is. You might hold it a little. So it's by Maplewood Mall, and which is fairly close to here, and maybe we can have you over there. But they have all sorts of events there, and it's an amazing, fun place. And they have hay rides and Halloween parties, and you know, it's just really neat to see people walk around a farm setting. We don't have very many animals, but they do bring in animals for, like, petting kind of stuff. And Representative Bennett could bring her dog, and they think that was a wolf, I think. but anyways, so that's my project, and it's preceded me. When I was at very first in the legislature, I was able to get $100,000 for a sprinkler system in the barn, and it was one of my, actually, when I retire someday, it's probably one of my proudest things, is because there's so many people that use that and get into it and have fun with it from all over the metro, and it's actually fun to, you know, see rural people come in, and, but I think they actually think it's pretty neat too. So, anyways, thank you.
What is the name of the farm or the?
It's a Bruntrup Farm. And
Bruntrup.
And I'm sorry, Madam Chair, and just one more thing. It's the neat thing about our, for me, is many of the people that were involved with it have passed, quite honestly. But the neat thing, not that they've passed is not neat, but it's, you know, but they've laid a base, you know, for all of us, and I think all of us are laying a base for our future, too, as we go forth. So I think that's always kind of an inspiration to me that these people have done good work and laid a great base.
I remember that farm, and I remember them coming to the legislature, various committees, to talk about it, and it didn't happen in one session or two sessions or three sessions. We heard about the Bruntrup Farm for quite a few. And so, but it's reality, it's changed the community, and you're moving forward with the farm there. And that's really something that I like to hear and see. Okay. Matt Kramer from the University of Minnesota, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Madam Chair, members, what I'd like to do this morning is give you, as per the homework assignment, three quick examples of the University of Minnesota and the investment that this legislature has made in the state's only R1 research land-grant university. Madam Chair, in 1947, this legislature appropriated the grand sum of $254,000 for a building up on a former dairy farm that was raising hay for the dairy operation in Duluth, Minnesota. That $254,000 built the first science building at what that same year was signed into legislation as the University of Minnesota Duluth. Fast forward 72 years, and that institution today employs 2,000 Minnesotans. It graduated last year, it has enrollment of almost 12,000 students, and through the Natural Resources and Research Institute has helped over 150 businesses and entrepreneurs either start operation or improve their operations. I'd say that $254,000 in 1947 was a remarkable investment. Many of you are familiar with the Carlson School of Business. The Minnesota School of Business, part of the University of Minnesota, started in 1919. And by the late 1980s, early 1990s, was desperately in need of new space. In 1996, this legislature appropriated funds for what is today the Carlson School of Management main building, and then shortly thereafter, due to significant growth, appropriated funds for Hanson Hall. What has been the impact? Well, ladies and gentlemen, in 1996, the Carlson School of Management had an undergraduate population serving over 65% of whom are Minnesotans of 1,000 students. This past year, over 2,600 undergraduate students, 1,600 graduate students, and a 97% placement rate 4 months after graduation joining the economy. And as we know from our own data, almost three-quarters of all University of Minnesota graduates across the board statewide remain in the state of Minnesota. Importantly, the Carlson School of Management also provides entrepreneurial services for businesses across the state of Minnesota. And since the addition and founding, over 15,000 Minnesota entrepreneurs have attended adult education courses at the Carlson School of Management. In 1904, this legislature challenged the state of Minnesota to create what today is the Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. The Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, located on our St. Paul campus, is a national leader in providing rapid diagnostic of animal diseases. That includes emerging diseases, new diagnostic methods, and in our case, training diagnostics and veterinary medicine professionals. We have procedures, or over 1.2 million procedures performed annually, with services offered in both St. Paul and in the Wilmer location. The Veterinary Disease Laboratory was appropriated in 1955, $600,000 for a 70,000 square foot expansion. The lab size was doubled in 1992 when the state funded a $7.9 million expansion. What has been the result? Today, that laboratory serves not only things like the bovine tuberculosis threat that many of you are familiar of in the early 2000s, but also the highly pathologic, I don't have a dental issue, but I simply cannot pronounce pathogenic, avian flu influenza in 2015, and has been instrumental in our work on chronic wasting disease in deer. The VDL Molecular Laboratory is now among the most advanced in the nation and has the capacity to perform over 500 samples a day, many of with real-time results provided that very same day. Most recently, in 2015, this legislature appropriated $8.5 million for an expansion of the VDL in Wilmer, serving the Animal Health Poultry Testing Laboratory for the Minnesota's nation-leading poultry industry. Madam Chair, members, these were just three very quick examples of investments this legislature has made in the University of Minnesota. I would also draw your attention to that investment in 1947 for the then science building, today chemistry building on the University of Minnesota Duluth campus, is desperately in need of HEPR funds, higher education asset preservation. Since 1994, this legislature has seen fit to appropriate $444 million in HEPR funding to the state of, or to the University of Minnesota, for which we are incredibly grateful. As you may know, the University of Minnesota maintains over 30 million square feet in both our campuses around the state, but also research and outreach centers across the state. Over 90% of that space was actually built in the 20th century. 500,000 square feet of it was actually built in the 18th century, in the late 1800s. the 21st century is going to be, for the University of Minnesota, all about renewing our existing facilities. And so we very much thank you for your support of the university and new investments, but also in HEPR. Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. This was great.
Thank you.
That was just following the directions, just perfect. We did miss one little point on the first project that you mentioned, the Natural Resources Research Institution at UMD, but it was on the Hermantown campus. It's located in Hermantown. In August, we had a wonderful celebration of the 35th year anniversary. And several people at this table were in attendance, and it was a nice, nice event. So thank you for putting that in your list.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Kramer. Keeping HEPR in mind and the HEPR obligation that we have, do you have any idea how many buildings the University of Minnesota owns?
Madam Chair, Representative, I apologize. I do, but I don't have that number right in front of me, and I'm certainly happy to get it back to you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And we would appreciate having that information at a later time, too, because we're going to be talking about the university at another time, too. But this was just the umbrella for those discussions to take place.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Do we have a volunteer from the committee? Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the invitation to continue homework. I think back to the days of the first Legacy Committee, and you were the chair and made a variety of homework assignments during our tenure on that committee. And I did my best. I never did get a grade, Madam Chair, but I think I passed. I don't know.
I can't remember exactly, but I know that no one got a score of less than B. And if I'm not mistaken, you were up in the A's, but I can't remember if it was a minus or a plus. So I think it was just a plain, good, solid A.
Maybe I'll put in a request for my transcript, Madam Chair. Well, thank you. I'm going to start out with kind of a general statement about bonding and our situation here in Minnesota. I just like to remind all of us that the state of Minnesota already owns a lot of stuff. And we heard about it from the university, but it's not just buildings at the university. It's all sorts of assets all around the state of Minnesota. And while it's a lot of fun to build new stuff, and we all enjoy, you know, the ribbon cuttings and the dedications, if we neglect the assets that we already own, we're doing the state a great disservice. And whether it's another mile of road or another bridge or another building, we need to keep in mind that as we add to that inventory, we're then adding to that burden in the future for another future legislature to take care of those assets that we do build. So when we build, we want to build well, but we do need to make sure that we're caring for what we have. When it comes to digging back into the past, Madam Chair, I've decided to talk a little bit about the MRSI program. Now, we're probably not all familiar with that. It's the MRSI, which is a Minnesota Railroad, and I'm going to get this wrong if I don't read it, Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program. It was actually established in 1976. There was a time in Minnesota when we had a lot more miles of rail than we have today. Legislators in the 70s realized that we need to try and preserve some of those rails instead of seeing them all ripped up. So they established this program, which has invested millions of dollars over the years in our railroad system. I'm a farmer by trade. Getting my goods to market on rail rather than on a truck makes a lot of good sense, because when we put bulk commodities on the rails instead of on the roads, it saves a lot of wear and tear on our roads. In fact, they thought it was so important that by the 1980s there was a constitutional amendment passed that allowed general obligation bonds to be used to fund this program. And it's been a great success, Madam Chair, and something that's really important, not quite so sexy as some of the things we do around here, but still some of the nuts and bolts, basic things that are very important to the state's future, economic future, and something I would like to highlight. Madam Chair, that's really all I have to say this morning.
Well, I think you're running with your aide, and I think the advice that the former chair of Capital Investments gave us is something to keep in mind throughout all our deliberations as we go forth. Thank you very much. Is it Brian? Brian Yolitz?
Morning, Chair Murphy and Committee. I am Brian Yolitz, and I serve the 370,000 students, faculty, and staff of Minnesota State's 30 colleges and 7 state universities as Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities. When Jenny Ash shared your request to present to the committee stories about bonding projects that in some way changed the lives and culture of Minnesotans, I thought, great, that should be easy. And then she said, keep it to 5 minutes. And then the task got very difficult, up to 5 minutes. It's like asking a parent or a grandparent to talk about their favorite child or grandchild. Almost an impossible task. I could talk about individual projects that created or improved academic spaces at individual campuses for their liberal arts or business programs, the science and technology laboratories, or nursing and agriculture programs across the state. But there's more to tell. I could talk about a bigger initiative like the creation of Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College by the Minnesota Legislature in 1987 the Tribal College was chartered by the Fond du Lac Band that same year to serve and meet the educational needs of a diverse population in the region around Cloquet. Southwest Minnesota State University in Marshall was founded in 1963 and opened in 1967. And grew with initial capital investments in the Billows Academic Center, their Fine Arts Building, and the Physical Education Center as a public university offering high-quality four-year education in the liberal arts and professions to prepare students and produce scholars to become the leaders and thinkers and entrepreneurs of the future. At the time, the university was on the cutting edge of energy innovation and continues to set the standard for accessibility, especially around wheelchair-bound students. I would take this a bit further and argue that state bonding has transformed the entire state of Minnesota through investments in public higher education and in what is now Minnesota State's 54 campuses, creating and improving academic spaces that represent access to opportunity and affordable higher education for all Minnesotans. Much of this investment initially came in response to the GI Bill that historians say made college a cornerstone of middle-class American life and fueled a major expansion of higher education across the nation and here in Minnesota. This impact is evident in our numbers. Between 1950 and 1980, the campus academic spaces of Minnesota State colleges and universities grew by tenfold to meet the demand of to educate veterans and their families and to provide the highly skilled workforce the state needed for companies like 3M, General Mills, and then Northwest Airlines, and to fuel Minnesota's growing economy. I'm a product of the GI Bill and its transformative impact. My dad was able to get his electrical engineering degree after his service in the United States Navy, and my wife and sons benefited from the post 9/11 GI Bill earned through my service in the United States Air Force. Minnesota's strong investment and expansion of higher education between 1950 and 1980 served its purpose then and continues to serve us today by lifting up students and preparing them for life and roles in our workforce and in our communities. And this growing need is the basis for our board's request for HEPR funding this session. We look forward to outlining the specifics of that need later with you during the session. Let me close this with this, though. You may not see the specific impact of a capital investment by driving by a campus building, but you do see that when you attend the commencement ceremony in the spring or fall. A ceremony where you see a young child holding a sign that reads, "Way to go, Mom," as her hero walks across the stage, having overcome the challenges and seize the opportunity to go back to school and earn a certificate or degree to better her life and that of her kids. This transformative impact is happening today at the 54 campuses of Minnesota State. Public capital investment enables this to happen as is needed more than ever to keep this happening into the future. Thank you, Chair Murphy and the committee, for your time and attention this morning. I look forward to answering any questions and spending time with you more this session.
Thank you. We will welcome that, and thank you for the reminders about the veterans and the GI Bill and the changes that in the culture of America that those things, along with the universities and colleges and in the communities, made a difference. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative Stansted.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. So I was prepared to talk about a project in my community that was a Minsku project, but we just heard a little bit about that. So I'm actually going to talk about a project that happened back in I think the funding came from 1974, for the Iron Range Interpretive Center. And $500,000 was appropriated back then, which was a tremendous amount of money. The Iron Range Interpretive Center opened in 1977 and then later became known as Iron World and now is known as the Minnesota Discovery Center. This facility was built really as a museum or an opportunity to showcase the history and look towards the future of the Iron Range. It's a museum. It's an entertainment center currently. It's a research library. And it has a tremendous park with a trolley. This facility now will host various community events, concerts, outdoor concerts. We now have a restaurant on site, which is very exciting. It's home of the Polka Fest, if you've heard of that, and the Iron Man statue. The museum really was built to celebrate the immigrants who built the Iron Range and the mining region there. At Iron World or the Discovery Center, you can find multiple historical documents and artifacts that are related to the range. It's built on the old Glen Mine site, and currently it has 15 permanent exhibits. And these are just really tremendous exhibits. There's a tribute to Governor Rudy Perpich. It captures the blue-collar worker on the range. There's an exhibit that talks about the Ojibwe seasons, and it's just a wonderful site. It's an educational center as well. It's a place where many of our local school districts bring their students to just kind of give them an overall flavor, and they have I think they call it their earliest residence, and it's the Great Bison. There's a skeleton of a great bison from hundreds of thousands of years ago. I don't know. So it's just a wonderful place, and I would encourage you all to come and visit it if you haven't been there already.
It's ever-changing.
Yes, it is.
Yes. Thank you very much. The last time I went to the Interpretive Center, I was looking for Senator Tomasoni's cabin, and I needed directions. And so they drew me a little map and made sure I had their phone number so I could call them back if I got lost. It was really, they were very helpful, and I appreciated that. But so over the years, there've been hundreds, thousands of people that have had a good time at the Interpretive Center.
Madam Chair?
Absolutely.
Yes. Madam Chair.
Representative Nornes.
If I could add 2 cents, I visited that very unique place, but it's been a long time ago. And I'm glad to hear that it's still doing well. I went there during my first campaign to see Eddie Rabbit and Stonewall Jackson. And then I proceeded to lose that election. So it just, the lesson was to stay at home, but I still enjoyed that trip up there and would do it again. So glad to hear it's still doing well.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Chair Murphy, and thank you, Representative Sandsteed, for talking about Iron World. I can't help but talk about Iron World. Many of you may know I was commissioner of IRRB for 8 years, and Iron World is probably my biggest challenge. It was struggling, frankly. It's a state-owned asset, but it was also being managed by the board of IRRB, which, as you, many of you know, is a board of legislators. That maybe not the best operating group. But the communities of Chisholm and Hibbing and the surrounding area, they were so proud of this because it really is a preservation of a history that is so unique. I mean, it really isn't. You need to go up there and go through to understand the history of mining in Minnesota and what the Iron Range contributed to, not just the state of Minnesota, but the country, mm-hmm. and the impact that it had. And that needed to be preserved. And so I really came to appreciate that and worked for about 2 years to transform the governance of what is now Minnesota Discovery Center from state to nonprofit. And so back, I don't know, I guess it's probably 15 years now, that there's been a nonprofit board that's operating the Minnesota Discovery Center and keeping it alive and vibrant and important to the community. So just had to add that little piece of my history that I'm really proud of. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Hochstein, Mr. Evans.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm John Appitz. I'm a member of the law firm of Messerly & Kramer, and I've represented clients up here at the state capitol and in front of this committee for 30 years. And among them is the Minnesota Zoo, which we want to talk about for a few minutes. In fact, my first assignment when I got here, Ross Kramer said, this is your first assignment, was to monitor the bonding conference committee in 1990. That conference committee went for 36 hours straight, and when they got to the end of the road, there was no money left for the zoo. Those are two things I never want to have happen again. With me is Claudia Hochstein. She is the legislative affairs liaison with the Minnesota Zoo, and so we're kind of the past, present, and future faces of the Minnesota Zoo, among them, as you'll see up here at the state capitol. You asked us to share with you a 20th century bonding project that improved the lives of Minnesotans, and I can think of few projects that have made life better for millions of Minnesotans than the Minnesota Zoo. Going back into the 20th century, in 1973, this legislature authorized $25 million in bonding money to create the Minnesota Zoo. In today's currency, that would be $145 million. It required a $2 million private match as well. The zoo opened, the new zoo, a lot of you know it as the new zoo still, opened in 1978, and it was a unique state agency that had a threefold mission of providing recreation, conservation, and education to Minnesotans across the state. At its inception, the Minnesota Zoo was designed to be the kind of public-private partnership that Mr. Suzinski talked about last Tuesday. The first line of the chartering statute, Chapter 85A, if you want to go check it out and take a look, states that it's the intent of the legislature to foster a partnership between the private sector and the state of Minnesota for the purpose of operating a zoological garden. And in a later section, it says the zoological garden shall consist of adequate facilities and structures for the collection, habitation, preservation, care, exhibition, examination, and study of wild and domestic animals, including mammals, birds, fish, amphibians, reptiles, crustaceans, and mollusks. Kind of a broad charter that we were given. So we refined that charter down into what is our mission statement today, and that is connecting people, animals, and the natural world to save wildlife. Since then, with your help, the Minnesota Zoo has become one of the 10 best zoos in the nation. And people have contributed to this. Dakota County put 500 acres aside to house the zoo. It's the fifth largest zoo in the country because of that contribution. A couple of other examples spanning the decades that you've suggested. In 1994, with bonding support from this committee, Discovery Bay opened and allowed Minnesotans a chance to learn about marine life and experience the ocean from the very middle of the continent. And then in 2008, with state support again, the zoo opened the national award-winning Russia's Grizzly Coast, which hopefully you'll have the chance to see, an exhibit that offered a unique opportunity to experience nature on the other side of the world. A lot of private investment has gone into the Minnesota Zoo. More than 1.3 million people come to the zoo every year. 47,000 of them have family memberships. Minnesota corporations have contributed generously, from 3M to Medtronic to Cargill to Flint Hills Resources to Hormel Foods, U.S. Bank, and Health Partners. They've contributed more than $12 million to the capital investments in the zoo. That's corporate investments. Other private persons have put up a lot of resources as well. I think of Ned Dayton, who provided a $5 million matching grant for the zoo to build the Russia's Grizzly Coast. And there's an exciting future ahead for the Friends of the Minnesota Zoo, which I'd like Ms. Hochstein to tell you about.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Like Mr. Appett said, my name is Claudia Hochstein. I'm the legislative liaison at the Minnesota Zoo. And I'd like to talk about how the Minnesota Zoo provides a place not only for Minnesotans to recreate, but also to learn. We have conservation staff who have done great work in Minnesota, such as restoring the population of trumpeter swans in Minnesota. And these messages that they learn, that people learn from being at the zoo and just connecting to animals, serves to strengthen the Minnesotan ethic for conservation and protecting the environment. We at the Minnesota Zoo inspire the next generation of conservation and environmental stewards. But as a public-private partnership, we generate about two-thirds of our annual $27 million operating budget from the state, or from private, or from ourselves and private donors. But the state supplies about a third of our funding. We depend on the legislature, and especially this committee. Much of the capital support is required to keep the Minnesota Zoo vibrant, fresh, and interesting. The zoo's 40 years old. We've served almost 50 million guests in that time, 1.3 million last year, and thousands more through external programs like Zoomobile, which bring the Minnesota Zoo around to every corner of the state where people might not be able to make it down to the metro to visit the zoo. We recently opened access to Minnesotans who use SNAP, WIC, Head Start, or other safety net programs so that they can visit the zoo for free. We served over 89,000 people through those programs last year. To ensure that our zoo keeps up with modern standards and is around to help serve the people of Minnesota for another 40 years, we do require serious attention and upkeep to our infrastructure at the zoo. With over 644,000 square feet of buildings, 25 miles of fences, and 10 miles of roads and pathways, the zoo is a small city. This committee has been very supportive to us in the past in helping us develop iconic exhibits. But over the next decade, we need a robust and ongoing capital investment to refresh and renovate our $100 million state asset, an asset that generates $223 million in economic impact and sustains 2,265 jobs every year. With your support, the Minnesota Zoo can provide Minnesotans with new opportunities to connect with nature, to get outside, to see wildlife in a new way, and to get healthier both mentally and physically. The zoo was conceived as a partnership with the state, and we're very proud of that partnership. We're committed to the relationship, and we do need the support of the Minnesota legislature and specifically this committee to maintain our status as one of the best zoos in the nation, a cultural gem for all Minnesotans to enjoy, and a place that inspires the next generation. We sincerely thank you for your time today, Madam Chair, and we're happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Appetz, when you were, I did go look up the statute book. Just
I saw you doing that.
Reference them. You forgot one thing in the charter. There was something about the Zoological Garden as the official pollinator bank for the state of Minnesota. Pollinator bank means a program to avert the extinction of pollinator species by cultivating insurance breeding populations. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I think we'll be talking about that in a few hours in your committee and have some critters along with us as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. To preface my report, I think it's important to kind of demonstrate the shifting demographic trends over the past 30 years in Savage. In 1990, Savage had a population of just under 10,000 people. In 1996, with the construction of the Highway 169 Bloomington Ferry Bridge, Savage at that point in time had a population of just over 15,000. And as a result, this quickly growing town required a more sophisticated infrastructure to support the growing population and growing community that it was going to become. So thanks to Ms. Nash, we were able to find really only one project prior to the turn of the millennia that was funded in part by the state. In 1999, the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority made a $9 million loan to the city of Savage to help us improve our drinking water infrastructure. In part, this is funded by, or this was supported by, general obligation bonds from the state. So in 1999, our population was 18,000 people. And today, the city of Savage has a population of 31,000 people. So since 1990, we've seen a threefold increase in our population. It is essential, I think, to support the quality of life in all of our communities, to have a sophisticated water infrastructure without which no community can thrive. So this was really a fascinating project to explore as our town continues to grow and as Savage continues to be a magnificent place to live.
Thank you very much, and good job, even though it's 1999, right? And all I said was 20th century. That's all I said. That's good. That's good. City of St. Paul. You didn't get them.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning. Members. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. My name is Jamie Tincher. I'm the Deputy Mayor in the City of St. Paul. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you, Jenny Nash, for all the work that you do. We're really happy to be here. We love an opportunity to talk about great things happening in the City of St. Paul. This year, under the leadership of our mayor, Melvin Carter, we are making significant investments in affordable housing, roads, and repairing and reconstructing our roads, and in our children and families through investments in our libraries and our rec centers. We have some incredible private sector partnerships. The beautiful soccer stadium that you see on the highway, we're looking forward to the opening game in a couple months. We hope you join us. The Ford redevelopment site, after more than a decade of planning, we are looking forward to partnering with Ryan Companies and seeing that redevelopment come to fruition. And we have some incredible partners in Ramsey County, and we look forward to working with them on their bold vision about redeveloping our riverfront. But we know that our most critical partnership as the capital city is our partnership with the state. In so many ways, you have supported our city through bonding for things like our Emerald Ash Borer situation, the Como Zoo, the Science Museum. I could go on and on, but our instructions were to look at prior to the 2000, and so I'm joined by Bill Huppenbecker. He's the Senior Director of Planning and Public Affairs with the Minnesota Wild, and he helped pass a bonding project in 1998 that led to the development of the arena for the Minnesota Wild, and so he is going to give some comments about that and how it's impacted our city. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. In the 98 bonding bill, the state provided $65 million for the construction of the Xcel Energy Center, which resulted in the NHL approving the expansion of Minnesota Wild franchise to the state of Minnesota. The arena opened in September of 2000, and in 2003 there was an economic impact study done. It was a little dated now, but at that time it determined the center supported 1,100 jobs, the 600 full-time equivalent positions, just with the new business coming to the state. And in that year, It generated $3.87 million in income tax to the state. Since then, that number's grown to over $10 million a year that's paid in state income tax. Total arena attendance is 2.1 million a year, and that includes wild hockey, state tournaments, concerts, and other events. A handout that you showed that we handed out has just a picture of the outside of the arena. We also had the hosted opening night ceremonies of the Super Bowl last year, and then a shot before the playoffs. And then the next page is hosting the Frozen Four, the UMD Bulldogs, at the Xcel Energy Center, a pink concert, and then one of the state tournaments that we host. We have girls and boys hockey, volleyball, and wrestling at the arena. And so we've also hosted some national events. Besides the Frozen Four, we've had U.S. figure skating and Olympic trials for gymnastics, and obviously the NCAA Frozen Fours. And then in addition to the income tax generator, the impact to the state, the Xcel Energy Center annually generates $10 million in state sales tax revenue, $700,000 in city sales tax revenue, and also $700,000 in the Ramsey County Transit tax from, and that sales directly at the arena. It's nothing outside bars, restaurants. It's directly paid from arena events. And then development outside of the arena, a lot of you are familiar with St. Paul. It took some time, but from 7th Street, you go into Chestnut and Walnut. Over the years, there's most of those buildings have been rehabilitated as new bars, restaurants, and resulted in expansion of Cassettas. And the latest development was the Hampton Inn and Oxbow housing on 7th Street. And then also support some of the downtown businesses, some of the restaurants on St. Peter, as well as the hotels. And so development continues to happen around the arena. There's a new housing development just behind 7th Street that's almost completed. And there's the surface parking lot across from the arena is probably going to be developed this spring for a hotel and housing. So it continues to spur development in that area. And lastly, this year, Visit St. Paul is going to recommission a new economic development study of the whole complex, the River Center and the Xcel Energy Center, to kind of update some of the numbers. But that just gives you a perspective of the payback to the state and the impact on the city, the positive with all the visitors coming to the city and development of other businesses around the arena.
Very good. Thank you very much. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real briefly, many Minnesotans are super excited about the incoming soccer stadium, so might have to expand it. It sounds like we need a bigger stadium even, but everybody's very excited about it, so I'm
great.
Glad that's coming forth.
We'll make sure you all get invitations. We're very excited. It's beautiful.
Thank you very much. And welcome back to the SLB, Ms. Dinscher.
Thank you. And that reminds me, we have with our St. Paul delegation and the mayor, we have a welcome back reception on Tuesday, January 22nd, that you're all invited to. It's at the Children's Museum, which was another project that received wonderful support from the state. So we hope you can make it on Tuesday.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for this opportunity. One of the advantages of being on the Capital Investment Committee is taking the tour and seeing a lot of these projects during the years, but, you know, getting this perspective of the past of these projects. And so I was digging through trying to find something that would have been about the time that you joined the legislature, and the Rochester flooding that occurred. Flood mitigation was one of the first projects that was brought up, so all the way from northern Minnesota and the Redwood River down to the Zumbro River, our state has made that investment. And many people aren't aware of this if you've not traveled to Rochester and aren't aware of the history. Our city is really defined by two natural disasters, one being the tornadoes that occurred in the 1860s that actually brought the Sisters of St. Francis Assisi to start and convince a young doctor who had two sons that were practicing with him to open up a hospital in our community. That was obviously an important historic event. But then the flooding that happened in the 1970s in the city of Rochester that really wiped out entire neighborhoods, and we had long-standing issues with drainage in the state of Minnesota or in that area. And so with the partnerships between the Army Corps of Engineers, the state of Minnesota allowed a first-time half-cent sales tax that the city of Rochester put on commerce that was taking place in the city of Rochester at that time. And so that half-cent sales tax was a big part, and the state was a long-standing partner on making that happen. And today, of course, the largest private employer in the state of Minnesota is in Rochester, and that's important as we continue to grow and thrive and invest in the DMC zone of the city. And that growth just really is a regional, statewide, and frankly a Midwest investment for quality health care for people around the world. And I'm very proud of that, and I think that without that investment by the state of Minnesota back in the early 80s, then is when they came around and made those requests. That was something that has made a huge difference to people throughout the world.
Thank you very much. David Kelleher. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to talk a little bit about the work that we do at the Minnesota Historical Society. I'm David Kelleher with the Minnesota Historical Society. Talk a little bit about what we do and the impact that we've had, and then why this is really important to the state of Minnesota, to the people of Minnesota. We operate the Historic Sites Network in partnership with the state of Minnesota. That's Chapter 138, and I've got a couple of brochures that describe that network across the state that ranges from Split Rock Lighthouse to Jeffers Petroglyphs in the Southwest. 26 sites, all different ages that are available for the enjoyment of Minnesotans. The Minnesota Historical Society itself was created by the territorial legislature in 1849, so I'm going into the 19th century as well as the 20th century. But really, the Historic Sites Network is a more recent activity of the Minnesota Historical Society. As people became more aware of the importance of historic preservation, and there were a few threats to significant buildings in the 1950s and 1960s, and as the National Historic Preservation Act was passed, that's when your predecessors and previous legislatures and our predecessors at the Minnesota Historical Society took action to preserve specific places, but also make them available to the public as educational facilities. Today, we operate a network of 26 sites, which has 140 structures. Half of those are historic, and of course, those historic places need extra care. In many cases, they were not designed to be museums and places that are heavily visited, so that extra care, because of the traffic, is necessary for investment. The bonding projects that you all have worked on and your predecessors, and I really appreciated the spreadsheet that Mr. Lee did for the last 18 years, and if you look back over the previous 30 or 40 years, really those projects are asset preservation, preserving historic structures, and then some of the more modern visitor centers and places where we have a place for people to get out of the weather, enjoy an exhibit, have visitor facilities like restrooms. So asset preservation and more modern structures. Madam Chair, I did not exactly follow the homework assignment and bring a picture, but what I did do is bring an example of asset preservation needs. Maybe about 10 years ago, we redid the roof of the Hill House, and I hope you all have had a chance to visit the Hill House just right up the street on Summit Ave. The Hill House roof is a beautiful slate roof that's held up by metal brackets. So we did a tour of the construction project as it was happening, and we talked to the construction workers, and they told us how that system was failing. And they gave us what was left of the metal that was holding up the slate roof, and we asked them what that looked like originally, and they had a piece of what they were replacing it with, what it looked like originally. So this is what it looks like today and what it looked like originally. This is what was left holding up the slate roof of the Hill House. So
got there in the nick of time.
Yep. So that's some of the needs for those older structures that that we're responsible for in partnership with you. So why is this important? There's an economic benefit from historic sites. Tourism is an important part of our economy, and studies have shown that people go to historic places. That's one of the top reasons that they take trips. If you're at the Forest History Center in Grand Rapids, you're probably going to stop for lunch, maybe stay overnight on your way to or from there. If you're at Mill City Museum in Minneapolis, you're also going to have an economic impact. And that facility had an economic impact beyond just the day-to-day visitation, where that area was transformed based on history into a brand new neighborhood after the mills closed down in the central riverfront. But I think more importantly, the impact of these places is as educational facilities. Our mission statement is using the power of history to transform lives, and that's what these places do. They give a sense of place. They allow people to experience history where it happened and experience the structures and the landscapes where history happened. So you think of places like historic Fort Snelling, Split Rock Lighthouse, Mill City Museum, Jeffers Petroglyphs, just to name a few. Those are places that provide really important educational experiences. We welcome nearly a million visitors in person per year to historic sites and museums in the network, as well as the History Center. So that's an educational impact, including school kids who come on organized tours to those places. Madam Chair, I don't know that I can name a favorite place, just one, but a couple to think about the impact. Historic Fort Snelling has so much potential with the many stories that we have told the military history in the past. We'll continue to do that, but the story of Dred Scott, the story of the Japanese Dred and Harriet Scott, who both lived at the fort, the Japanese-American language school that helped to shorten the war by a couple of years, and then just so many more stories, Native American stories. Jeffers Petroglyphs, if you haven't had a chance to visit there.
We're going there.
Great.
We're going there.
Excellent. Madam Chair, go at the beginning of the day or the end of the day, and you'll be able to see the petroglyphs better. So we would love to host
We'll have you closely plan our trip.
Excellent. And Split Rock Lighthouse, you can't beat the sense of location there. If you're there during a storm, then you know why that was built to guide the ore boats coming into port safely. So, Madam Chair, again, thanks. We look forward to hosting you on some tours this summer and fall. And there are so many important historic places beyond just what we operate. Other places that we've heard about today, there are so many needs out there for historic structures that we hope, in addition to the Historic Sites Network that we're responsible for, that you'll support across the state. And Madam Chair, one last thing. I just have to recall when you talked about the St. Louis River and Willard Munger. I had the opportunity with my family to go on a canoe trip with Willard Munger that he hosted. And our son, who was then about 3 or 4, was so relaxed on that peaceful wide river that he had his arm in the water and he fell asleep. And now he's a lanky 6'4" young adult, but that's a special place too. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Happy to answer any questions about this work.
And there was a big picnic at the end of the canoe ride, right?
It was really, really special. Thanks.
Yes. Andy Pomeroy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andy Pomeroy. I'm government relations at a firm of Fredrickson and Byron. And I think largely because folks on the committee and folks in the audience have already spoken, at least in some way, about most of the projects that I actually represent in front of this committee, whether that be things in Minneapolis, flood issues in the Moorhead area. Actually, last year had the privilege to represent the Lake Superior Zoo, not the Minnesota Zoo. But I want to talk about a project, not that I represent, not that has any future needs, at least not that I know of, in this committee, but just a project back where I grew up. So I grew up on the east side of St. Paul that, you know, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, was a very middle-class neighborhood, working class, a lot of blue-collar jobs, manufacturing. That was the original headquarters that was in Two Harbors, Madam Chair, but one major headquarters of the 3M company that since moved out to Maplewood. Whirlpool had a major manufacturing plant there. There was a lot of those types of facilities on the east side of St. Paul. By the time we got into the late 80s, into the 90s, the east side had lost over 3,500 manufacturing jobs. The community had 17% unemployment at a time when the state had a 2% unemployment. 40% of folks living on the east side of St. Paul were living in poverty, depending on how you measure it. At that time, there was a public-private partnership that formed called the Phelan Corridor Initiative. When I was in college, I had the opportunity to spend a summer working with the Phelan Corridor. And basically what that project worked on was taking an old railroad corridor that ran kind of the heart of the east side and put a new road through there, connected the east side to downtown and the capital area, into the actual neighborhood, provided better connections, and provided opportunities for redevelopment. Since that road was built, there's been over $1 billion of new investment. I don't have the actual employment figures over there, but it's remarkable. Some of the new employers over there are the Carpenters Hall, built their Union Hall and training facility right in the middle of that. Health Partners has a pretty major campus on the east side that didn't exist before. There's printers. There's a number of different employers that have existed. There's a old school that had closed that's reopened as a partnership with the YMCA over on Arcade. There's a climbing gym. There's all sorts of things that are bringing people back to the east side, new restaurants, new housing. There's hundreds of new units of housing over there. There's a restored wetland. The state invested in that with the new BCA headquarters kind of at the eastern, northeastern end of that corridor. There's multiple new banks there that are doing lending to folks in the community. The old Stroh Brewery used to be there. That closed a number of years ago, and now located in that same site are Flat Earth Brewing and 11 Wells Distillery, so keeping the tradition of alcohol production on the east side. So that's just an example of something the state put that I was able to track down. There was a $5 million appropriation 1 year and a $4 million appropriation the other year. So just $9 million from the state has led to over $1 billion of private investment, and it's a true success story. So thank you.
Thank you very much. That's a good perspective that we need to keep in mind. Brian Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Brian Rice. I'm with the law firm of Rice, Michaels, and Malther, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. This legislature created the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board in 1883 and directed it to create a park system in and adjacent to the city of Minneapolis, and that's what it's been doing now for over 130 years. And actually, the first state park was created by the legislature in 1889, Minnehaha State Park, and the legislature created it and directed the city to park system to manage it. The the direction that you gave as a project in your region that inspired you or changed the lives or culture of people who live or work by it. And what I want to talk about briefly today is the Metro Regional Park System. In 1975, Jim Casserly, who was a state representative from North Minneapolis in a district that's pretty much coterminous with Representative Dean, carried the bill to create the Metropolitan Regional Park System, which consists of 10 implementing agencies, all the counties in the metropolitan area, the city of St. Paul, Minneapolis, Bloomington, and what's now known as Three River Park System, Carver, Scott, Dakota, Anoka, Ramsey, Washington counties as well. And those 10 implementing agencies currently manage 56 regional parks, comprised of 55,000 acres, 400 miles of interconnected trail system. And it's a system that's really grown and become integrated since then. They're really the equivalent of the state parks in the metropolitan area. And last year, we served over 58 million user visitors. I'd submit it's the best investment the state and our local governments have made in terms of the land, but also the health of our citizens. I think one of the reasons why we have great health outcomes in this state is because of our park system, our trail system, and certainly not only in the metropolitan area, but the DNR system, outstate parks. It's the best and least expensive health club membership you can buy. It works out to about $1 a visit, and it really it's a system that's loved to death and really used. And some of it is not. Representative Torkelson made a good point about buildings and infrastructure. They're very expensive to maintain. One of the great, and I'd say the genius, at least, of the Minneapolis park system, most of our regional parks are not buildings. They're trails. They're landscapes. The beauty is not in a building. The beauty is in a place or a design. And one that I want to, specific one of those 56 regional parks I want to talk about is the Central Riverfront Regional Park. That's the park that's around Nicollet Island in Minneapolis. Basically goes from the Stone Arch Bridge past the Hennepin Avenue Bridge up to the Plymouth Avenue Bridge. It's an area that I went to De La Salle High School and graduated in 75. So in the early 70s, I went to school there every day, and it doesn't look at all like what it looks like today. Back then it was an industrial area, railroad yards, manufacturing plants, no people, or there were people, but they were people that were what we'd call homeless now or sheltered people. There was Salvation Army. There was it was kind of the low-income part of the city. But with Representative Casserly's bill creating it in 75, a unified system, the Metropolitan Council put aside $40 million of its own money, and then starting in 1976, the legislature started appropriating money that needed to be matched by the Met Council to build out this system. The cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul, Ramsey County, Anoka County had existing parks. Three Rivers did. They basically contributed them, and these are the large parks. They're not neighborhood parks. They're parks of several hundred acres. And then with the assistance of the state and the Met Council, the system got built out into all the other counties. And this park particularly benefited by about $100 million of investment. 60% of it came from either the city of Minneapolis, the Met Council, about $40 million from the state. But that $100 million investment led to over $4 billion in private investment. The Federal Reserve is there. When the project was designed, I think our planners thought that it would bring in office buildings and things like that. Actually, what happened were housing units. If you go down in that area, it's some of the most expensive housing in the state. Condominiums on both sides of the river. Some housing, the Guthrie Theater is there, and it's really been a remarkable process. There's an author named Peter Hendy Brown who wrote a book about why developers invest in places, and part of his book talks about riverfront developments. He's from Minneapolis, but he didn't talk about Minneapolis. He talked about Baltimore, Cincinnati, other cities that have invested in riverfronts, and maybe this even applies in Duluth. It's usually about a 40-year process to turn around older land. It just, you can't do it in a year or 5 years or 10 years. It's about 40 years by the time you start planning it, start acquiring it, and developing it. And that's about the cycle we've had in the Central Riverfront, where what you see today took a lot of planning, a lot of foresight, and it's really quite remarkable to see that area. Nicollet Island now is almost all in public ownership. There are some houses that will stay there for another 90 years. But it's the public now owns all the riverfront in that area. And there's trails that people use. That region, the Central Riverfront Regional Park, now has over 2.5 million user visits a year. It's approaching the use that we get on the chain of lakes. I'm sure many of you have gone around Lake of the Isles or Bidet-Makaska or Harriet Lake, Nokomis. But with people moving down there, it gets constant use. The vistas are amazing. The Stone Arch Bridge probably was central to making that happen. James J. Hill built that. But it's been a great partnership. I think it really has transformed the face of the city of Minneapolis down there, and I think all these parks do. I think I've given you one example of one of the 56. I think all the implementing agencies could tell you how valuable parks are to everyone, our health and even our economic development. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. We're going to cease with the reports today and continue them next week, and then we're going to go to Minnesota Management and Budget for the next part of the sixth part of the agenda, and we will do the fifth part of the agenda next week on Tuesday. Representative Lee, tell us what you were you going to ask a question? You wanted to make a statement. I know where you live.
Madam Chair, I was just going to ask Mr. Rice, since he was talking about parks, who has the top two park system in the country?
Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Thank you.
Right answer. Welcome. Thank you for coming. And you're going to tell us about debt capacity and how much we can possibly have, right?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Hassimer. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management at Minnesota Management and Budget. So, yes, we will be shifting gears here this morning and moving away from this wonderful summary of all these projects that the state has invested in the past and getting a little more technical. In your materials, you should have two pieces of information. The first is just a copy of our latest debt capacity forecast, about a 7-page document. That is for your reading pleasure. I will be referring to some of the information in there today, but also then just referring to the slides that hopefully you have a copy of in your materials. So first of all, I thought I would start by talking about the state's capital investment guidelines. And as a general matter, why even have guidelines? They can communicate policy goals and help decision makers make decisions and the important work before this committee. And they can demonstrate a long-term commitment to capital funding for the state's important needs. Why our specific guidelines, which I will walk through in more detail in the next few slides. But our guidelines are in line with how all of the rating agencies have looked at the state's debt portfolio and rate the state's bonds. They are inclusive of all of the state debt obligations that are outstanding, and they represent the state's strong financial management. So guidelines are most effective when they are comprehensive and include both current and proposed debt and all types of debt that an issuer might issue. When they have caps, so they set limits and targets that are adhered to, and when they are communicated so that decision makers and policy makers understand them and have the information that they need. Turning to slide three, I'll just walk through each of the guidelines in turn here. The first guideline looks at state outstanding debt that is supported by the general fund. And these are the bonds that the state has sold. And there is a limit that those shall not exceed 3.25% of state personal income. When we published our November debt capacity forecast, you can see that current outstanding debt represented only 2.41% of state personal income. The types of debt that are included in guideline number one are state-issued debt, which includes state general obligation bonds, both our various purpose bonds and our trunk highway bonds, as well as state appropriation bonds supported by the general fund. It also includes state-supported debt. So this includes debt issued by the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, where debt service is supported by a standing appropriation out of the general fund. And also lease purchase financings for real estate. And an example of this includes the St. Paul Port Authority bonds for the Anderson and Freeman buildings. One type of debt that is not picked up in our guidelines is what is called self-supporting debt. And this includes, for example, revenue bonds, where the bonds are paid back by a dedicated revenue stream and not paid back out of the state general fund. Turning to the next slide, our second capital investment guideline broadens the measure of debt that we are looking at to include all authorized debt. So that is debt that has both been sold and debt that is authorized but not yet sold. It includes all of the debt that I mentioned for guideline number one and also layers in state moral obligations issued by the State Housing Finance Agency and the Office of Higher Education, and as well as lease purchase financings for equipment such as our master lease program. The limit in guideline number two is that all of these obligations shall not exceed 6% of state personal income. And you can see we are well below that at only 3.82% of state personal income. Turning this to the next slide, our final capital investment guideline states that at least 40% of state general obligation bonds shall mature within 5 years, and 70% shall mature within 10 years. And currently, our outstanding general obligation bonds, we have more than 73% that are scheduled to mature within the next 10 years. And I'll mention here briefly that the Constitution does limit the maximum term of general obligation bonds to 20 years. The importance of this guideline is that it helps the cost of bonding bills be realized more quickly, which helps ensure that in the future there is fiscal capacity to continue with our ongoing financing of capital investments. Turning the page to the next slide, this is a table that we publish in our debt capacity forecast, and I thought I would just take a minute to orient you to this because this is actually a good snapshot of the state's debt portfolio and how we calculate and measure against our guidelines. First of all, the first column of numbers represents all of the principal that we have outstanding. So these are the bonds that we have sold, broken down into the various categories. And you can see that summed up at the bottom, a number that I've circled for you, we currently have $7.8 billion of outstanding net tax-supported debt. The next column over shows what amounts have been authorized by the legislature, but that the state has not yet sold. And currently, there is about $2.85 billion of authorized but unissued debt. And then the final column totals everything. And if you go all the way to the bottom, where it layers in the state moral obligations and equipment leases, you can see what is being picked up in guideline number two, all of the authorized debt. And that is currently about $12.4 billion. At the very bottom of the table here, we just show, again, the calculations, how we are measuring the percentages in the first two guidelines against the state personal income that I've circled for you as well. Approximately 80% of the state's debt portfolio is general obligation bonds, about $6.3 billion outstanding right now, with the other 20% representing the state appropriation debt, about $1.5 billion. And there is about, as I mentioned before, $12.8 billion that is authorized but unissued. Turning to the next slide, these guidelines, when we publish them in our debt capacity forecast, which we do publish twice a year in November and February in conjunction with the budget and economic forecast, they reflect a point in time calculation of the state's debt portfolio. Once the legislature authorizes new bonding, those bonds will first show up in guideline number two, And then once MNB issues those bonds or another agency issues those bonds, they will also appear in guideline number one. You may be interested to know that when bonds are authorized in a bonding bill, the state does not sell those bonds all at once. We sell those bonds on a cash flow basis. We work with the state agencies to understand what their financing and cash flow needs are, basically for a 12-month period. So when we sell bonds, we're trying to cash flow the projects for the next year. Turning to debt capacity then, what debt capacity tries to get at is how big could a bonding bill be? You may know that in the budget forecast, we do forecast future capital investment bills based on a historic 10-year rolling average. When we published our November debt capacity forecast, we updated the 10-year average. So now the forecast is assuming that there will be a $265 million bonding bill this session and in future odd-numbered sessions, and then $755 million in an even-year session. Turning to the next slide, which also tries to get at how big a bonding bill could be, this is a table that we include in the debt capacity forecast, and it's worth explaining. This attempts to show what the maximum bonding bill could be that could be authorized by the legislature this year. I'll caveat that this is in no way intended to be a recommendation in terms of a target that the legislature should be looking at. But what our goal was in producing this table was to maximize the first possible opportunity that the state would reach the limit in either guideline number one or guideline number two. You will see on the second line of this table that under our existing capital investment guidelines, the legislature could authorize almost $3.5 billion in new debt this session. And that would have the impact of reaching guideline number one in fiscal year 22. I will caveat that, again, is not a recommendation to the legislature. It is merely showing where we fall within existing guidelines. And the other line to focus on is the bottom line in the table, what the impact to the general fund would be based on the maximum amounts reflected in that second line. And I will also add that those maximum new debt authorization numbers could be split among any of the different bonding sources that are picked up in our guidelines, so general obligation bonds, trunk highway bonds, state appropriation bonds, and various real estate financings, including certificates of participation. So that is what I had for you today, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Those are really good numbers. 3.475 billion dollars on line two there, but then that brings down to the bottom line, like you said, goes down to zero then. And this is 2019, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you wanted to, the point you wanted to make. So maybe we shouldn't think as high as 3.475. Just doodling something here, committee members. But 265 million is so dinky compared to 3.475. We'll have to have conversations about this, I think. The question hands up. Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hasmer, are you able to provide any context to us where our bonding practices and debt capacity, how that relates to the bonding practices and debt capacities of other states in our region and perhaps other states in our country with similar population and demographic makeups of that of our state?
Madam Chair, Representative, that That is a very detailed question. Every state is different in terms of what their constitution permits in terms of borrowing authority and capacity. So it can make comparisons across states difficult, even with similar demographic profiles. But that being said, some of the rating agencies do publish reports that try to at least standardize some information across states. And certainly if you're interested, we could pull some of that together and provide it to you.
Thank you, Ms. Hassler. That'd be very much appreciated. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And when you provide it, perhaps we'll need an explanation of it, too, at that time.
Okay.
Representative Considine. Dine.
Representative Thank you, Considine. Chair Murphy. Thank you, Chair Murphy. We are still at a triple A bond rating for the state, though, because we have done this so responsibly in the past. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that is correct. And I would be remiss if I did not point out for this committee that the state did earn back a second triple A rating just last summer. So the state currently maintains two triple A ratings that we are very proud of.
Follow-up question, Chair Murphy?
Representative Considine, go
and
ahead.
That triple A rating saves us tens, if not hundreds, of millions of dollars every year in interest charges?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is true. A triple A rating translates into the lowest borrowing costs possible for the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, we didn't get through all the committee reports today. You have opportunities next week to continue, and I invite again the public or the lobbyists, followers of this committee, if you choose to make a report, up to five minutes, sign up with Ms. Nash sometime between now and the next meeting. This meeting was very, very beneficial to us in building the groundwork, putting in the pillars of our future. And I thank you all for your participation and your creativity. And Representative Stanset.
Just one quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the agenda for next Thursday, do you know if this meeting will be televised? I think what's coming up is going to be very helpful to local communities.
Thank you for reminding me about that. And Ms. Nash is going to ask that it be.
Thank you.
But I don't know what their response is. And speaking of that, before you go, committee members, if you see empty seats at this front and around here, it doesn't look so hot on TV. And so we should have people in those seats for sure. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate that you mixed it up today, too. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.